House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is May 17th, 2017. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 95B.
No, that's not fair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 95B requires licensed financial service professionals to report suspected financial exploitation of elderly persons and certain persons with a disability. The bill requires a report to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, who in turn is required to notify the Department of Human Services. The bill also authorizes these professionals to delay a financial disbursement if exploitation is suspected. Violation of the bill is punishable as a Class A violation, and the bill provides an exemption from liability for conduct made in good faith with reasonable caution and the exercise of reasonable care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I call Rick Blackwell, Aaron Tevabra, and Kristen Hale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, the policy manager with the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. This is the entity that regulates, among other things, securities professionals. So this bill addresses how our licensed securities professionals can play a role in detecting and deterring instances of suspected financial abuse of our vulnerable populations. Our Oregonians are getting older. I don't think any of us are going to disagree with that. 16% of Oregon is 65 or older. And
you know, Mr. Chair, I'm almost offended with that.
That's not how you start testimony.
Whoa.
It's a miracle city.
There are a number of us.
Especially when you look like he does.
Yeah. That,
that's the point.
Number of us with gray or receding hair. So.
I'm not.
No, me.
Oh, well.
You
certainly. Well, this is going to go well. So.
I was fine with it. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, again, our colleagues are, well, I'm just going to keep going. But in 2014, retirement assets are of those aged 65 to 74 were estimated nationally to be around $3.5 trillion. And persons over 50 account for roughly 75% of financial assets in the nation. So you have an issue where we have more boomers and other cohorts are getting ready for retirement. They have a lot of assets. As a result, there are instances of fraud. I don't think that's another thing that's going to be surprising to the committee. Approximately 1 in 5 senior citizens have been the victims of fraud, and a DHS report had a 19.6% increase in exploitation from 2014 to 2015. Victims only report financial abuse, though, in about 5% of cases, so we think this is a bit of an underreported statistic. On average, individuals lose around $25,000. I mean, it's not something to be flippant about. This is people's, on average, of life savings, and this is a very serious topic. Our financial advisors are in a unique position to detect and deter these types of abuse. They have long-term relationships with their clients. They're supposed to know their customers and know their investment patterns, understand a person's risk profile, and be able to tailor their investments to that. So if they're you start seeing unusual disbursements or folks that are new to the picture, they're in a good position to see those kinds of life patterns. So we're not the only state to take this on. Actually, there's 14 states that are currently considering or have adopted this into law. This is a model that the North American Securities Administrators Association, which is NASA for short, and obviously not the cool NASA, developed a model law for states to adopt either by statute or by regulation to empower securities professionals to make these reports. In OLIS, we submitted some testimony of support for the NASA model law from some national organizations that expressed their support for the model itself. So in 2016, we convened a work group to work through some issues associated with the model to see if we could incorporate it into Oregon law. So we included DOJ, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, AARP, DHS. We had CIFMA, the Trial Lawyers Association, the Oregon Law Center. The bankers were also on the Oregon Bankers Association was also on the committee. We did not receive complete consensus on the bill. We have asked for folks to report mandatorily, and that does require a lot of work on our part. What we have tried to do instead is to make sure that the reporting is as smooth as possible for those that would have to report under this bill. So also in OLIS, there is a testimony letter from Victoria Blackley, I believe, who is on the Oregon Commission on Senior Services, who is also supporting the bill. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to my colleague, Erin Tieverbaugh, and she'll go ahead and go through the basics of the legislation.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Erin Tieverbaugh. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation. The key components of the bill are the mandatory reporting. The mandatory reporting levels the playing field between the vast majority of firms who want to do the right thing and those who may not want to jeopardize their client relationships without either incentives or protection to do it. The mandatory reporting, we feel, brings the issue to the attention of the appropriate folks, DCBS with regard to the securities aspect and DHS with regard to investigating the possibility or the reasonably believed senior financial exploitation or vulnerable person financial exploitation. The bill would make the report to DCBS, and then we would immediately send it to DHS as the primary investigator of these types of abuse allegations. We've committed to working with DHS to make sure that there is a smooth, responsible transfer of information. We think we can use our existing complaint capture form in order to forward reports to DHS at the same time that we get them. So the reports would actually, you know, come to us, so you didn't have dual reporting where you had to report here and then turn around and report here, but one single report to us, and it'll be funneled to both of us and both agencies at the same time. We have worked to clarify the bill so that firms can contact other persons as authorized by law or customer agreement. One of the aspects of the bill is that you have the option to contact people, trusted third parties on the account to say, what's going on here? Is everything okay with, you know, the primary account holder, I've noticed that something's a little off, so that we can make sure, or so that the investment advisors, broker-dealers can make sure or can at least form some sort of reasonable belief that a report is going to be required under this, or that maybe things okay. The ability to ask first and kind of check into things, do your own little look-see into it. One of the provisions of the bill, so you can contact a trusted third party except if that person is the one that you suspect of the financial exploitation. About 46% of abuse is perpetrated by family members, and so if you suspect that the person who would be authorized on the account is the person actually perpetrating the abuse, then you wouldn't, then the bill would say, no, you don't contact them. You can contact anybody else that you're allowed to by law, but let's not make things worse. The bill, it requires qualified individuals to report suspected cases of abuse. We've worked with stakeholders to make sure that qualified individuals wraps in everybody in a firm's line of reporting. Many firms already have procedures. They already have internal mechanisms to forward suspicious activity, suspicious disbursements up through their own investigatory stream. So we've clarified that qualified individuals isn't necessarily just the salesperson, the broker-dealer, the investment advisor themselves, but anybody in a supervisory capacity in the written procedures of a firm, so that we're not actually stepping on top of procedures that are already in place in order to handle this very important matter. We make sure that the timelines are reasonable, essentially. Generally, the reporting standard for mandatory reporters is immediate. On the Senate side, that was changed to be as soon as practicable. So that was thought to be more understandable than immediate, which could be, all right, I'm dropping everything, and now I have to do it right now, so hold on for a second, I'll be right back, versus as soon as you can get to it. You know, as soon as this is important to do it quickly, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're dropping everything. It means that the second you get a chance to, then you would report it. One component of the bill is that it would allow a broker-dealer and investment advisor to delay a suspicious disbursement. The initial delay would be for up to 15 days, unless there is a court order that says, no, this is done now, or an order from us that said, no, this is done now. We have the ability under the bill to expand that for an additional 10 days. There's another additional expansion if things get very complicated for either the department or the broker-dealer investment advisor who's placed the hold on the disbursement to go to a court and say, we need to delay this for longer to make sure that the assets don't disappear. Because once they disappear, they're generally unrecoverable. Immunity is provided for good faith notification of the suspected abuse, for notification to the trusted third party, and also for the delay of disbursement. So it provides a state immunity from criminal, administrative, or civil actions for action for reports, information, or delays taken in good faith with reasonable care.
So, Mr. Chair, we in the committee, when the committee was deliberating this in the Senate, Roger Beyer, or NAFA, the independent financial advisors, had raised an issue of training, which is a very good point. We agree with him that we do need to figure out some way to deliver training to broker-dealers and investment advisors to make sure that they feel comfortable making these reports. So we are right now working on developing training based on NASA's Senior Safe Toolkit, which is the same entity that produced the model law. It goes through the whys and the hows of suspected abuse. No matter how today goes, and since my kickoff was so well, we'll be delivering that training starting in June of 17. We're looking also to make sure that insurance, although insurance professionals are not covered by this bill, and securities professionals get appropriate continuing ed to when they take the training. So with that, I think I'll go ahead and end our testimony.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Christian Hale. I'm the legal services developer and policy analyst with Oregon's Department of Human Services, Aging and Disabilities. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing our testimony today. The department is excited to support Senate Bill 95 because it is an excellent tool to help with the fast and efficient investigation of financial exploitation reports, allegations of abuse that would seriously harm the assets and arguably the health of elders who stand to lose from this type of wrongdoing. Our agency is statutorily charged with all elder abuse investigations, not only financial exploitation, but also physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, unauthorized physical and chemical restraint, wrongful isolation, abandonment, verbal abuse, and self-neglect. And the reason I mention those other types of abuse today is because our investigators have found that it's not uncommon for more than one type of abuse to be occurring for any individual elder. For example, somebody who may be exploited financially could also be being isolated, could also be having their medications stolen. They could be withheld opportunity to go to the doctor. This is part of the reasoning, I think, why mandatory abuse reporting has become more prevalent over the years, and we're pleased to see that certain additional financial professionals identified through this bill will now also be able to promptly report their concerns. As was previously mentioned by our colleagues at DCBS, some of the steps that the financial institutions will take, such as, for example, delaying disbursements, are optional to them. However, I'm pleased to see that the bill does provide good guidance on when they might choose to do that, and it does rely on the reasonable belief that wrongdoing may be occurring. The bill also supports DCBS reporting directly and immediately to DHS so that Adult Protective Services can commence as soon as possible. In addition, it clearly allows, as do Oregon's other mandatory abuse reporting laws, for notification to law enforcement when a crime is suspected. In some representatives, I believe that with the trifold approach of monitoring by DCBS of potential securities violations, monitoring of abuse, and an investigational response to abuse by Adult Protective Services within Department of Human Services, plus the potential involvement of law enforcement to investigate and prosecute crimes, I think we have an excellent tool to help prevent financial exploitation for vulnerable Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. So I have one question. These people are also under federal regulations. The banks are not mandatory reporters, and so why are these people, why are we required mandatory reporting?
Chair Barker, so a couple reasons. One, the financial institutions, so banks and credit unions, both are, they are regulated by us for safety and soundness. They, this is a model law that as we're pursuing this with other states, we're trying to keep this within the confines of the model, and really we were focused on securities professionals. It's also my understanding that financial institutions are, by practice, good reporters of financial exploitation and abuse. And so at this point, although if the conversation needs to happen, we'd like to be at the table, of course, at this juncture, it didn't seem necessary for us to fold in either financial institutions or insurance folks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I understand this, so whomever maybe could answer this question, as I've been reading this and trying to understand it. For instance, there's a portion that says securities professionals were second only to family members in reporting suspected financial exploitation of seniors and vulnerable adults. What if, maybe I'm missing this, but what if it's the securities professionals? And I guess when I think of that, I think of stockbroker / financial advisor / 401k guy, gal that runs that for my father, who would fall into this category.
Right.
What if they were the ones exploiting my father? Who's reporting on them? Is there a vehicle here for that?
Chair Barker and Representative Post, under current law, I mean, most firms are going to be supervising stockbrokers or investment advisors as long as there's not a sole practice. Someone in that entity would have some ability to report to us, just like a normal complaint process that we currently have. We can also examine broker dealers and examine investment advisors on a 3-year cycle, and we can take complaints from anyone about conduct that's going on with the broker dealer or the investment advisor. We've done in the last 5 years about 254 actions on fraud and other issues related to the licensees themselves.
So slight follow-up. Thank you. So just want to make sure. So you would be who a person would go to if they feel that they've been exploited. Are you sort of the final authority on that? I'm looking for a direction with this because I'm hearing a lot of things in here I really, really like, which has changed literally since we've been sitting here. So.
Right.
So your start was really good.
Oh, Chair Barker and Representative Post, for follow up. Yeah, we absolutely are the ones, the entity that would be responsible for taking action if there's misconduct that's perpetrated by the licensee themselves. And we would definitely encourage complaints be given to our office because sometimes we need to know it for us to be able to take appropriate action to help investors.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, you asked the question, and so I'll voice the concern that I have. Recently did this with bankers, 2622, mm-hmm. I think it was. They're not mandatory reporters. I'm a little concerned about carving out this one segment and making them mandatory reporters. I don't see financial advisors being reticent to report. I don't see that at all.
Chair Barker and Representative Springer, no, I don't believe the vast majority of folks would want to, but there is a point where I think an Oregonian should be able to walk into the office of an investment advisor and know that if there is an issue, that they're not gambling on whether the person will report or not. And that would be, I suppose, our view on mandatory reporting. I mean, folks can obviously agree to disagree on that point. So,
Chair Barker and Representative Springer, if I may, I have a follow-up to that.
Please.
Even though this bill is focused directly on mandatory reporting, it's long been the case that financial institutions, banks, credit unions, others, in fact, any member of the public, can voluntarily report abuse and have always been encouraged to do so. A couple of years back, DHS, through its Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, launched a statewide hotline for abuse reporting. And certainly that option for reporting continues to apply in addition to this. Another highlight of this bill I'd like to draw your attention to, and this tends to appear only in bills or statutes referencing mandatory reporting, is that this will now give DCBS, it'll give abuse investigators and law enforcement statutory authority and permission to obtain copies of the relevant financial information concerning the particular allegation of abuse. This is something that has long hampered adult abuse investigators who try to investigate financial exploitation involving banks. While it's certainly true they are extremely cooperative and provide what they can, they look generally, I believe, to federal law and interpretation of that to whether or not they can provide financial statements to an investigator without a subpoena, for example. One thing that this bill, Senate Bill 95, does that is particularly relevant and on point and would fix that is it does give abuse investigators authority and correlatively it gives the financial entities some comfort and authority to be able to provide those records to assist in the abuse investigation. I think that's a good step forward, representatives.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Christian, I just want to follow up with what you just said. Would you say that the majority of financial institutions are beyond the standard of reasonable belief in determining that the potential of a violation or a crime occurred, that they were at a point where actually it was beyond reasonable belief, or not reasonable belief, but like preponderance of evidence, or even let's say clear and convincing evidence to move forward with that a crime had occurred?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, I'm not completely sure I understand the question, but what I think you're referencing is when should a financial institution
report?
No,
that's not what I'm asking.
No, please do.
What I'm asking is would you say that the majority of the folks in financial institutions, when they see an event that occurs that is clearly a fraud or a violation occurring in front of them, it's well beyond that of reasonable belief?
As Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, respectfully, I'm not sure I can speak for those individuals. What I can say, though, is that through research and publication that Adult Protective Services has produced, bankers in 2015 did report 564 instances of suspected abuse. I would presume that at least the minimum standard of suspicion and reasonable belief was the case in those. But of course, some of those would be, I think, witnessed abuse. For example, in a bank, in front of bank tellers, if they saw something firsthand, whether it was rough treatment of an elder or threats or even something to do with financial transactions, they would be there as a witness and they would obviously have reasonable belief in those situations. What the DHS has always supported is that people report rather than not report if they have concerns.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we can continue on this. Rick, I want to ask you a question on Section 3. Mm-hmm. Because it does identify in this the issue about a qualified individual who has reasonable cause to believe. Now, I want to start there, but I want to walk through this whole section here because, to me, I'm looking at this section and I'm thinking, boy, you talk about a bunny trail. I mean, because if all of a sudden a qualified individual suspects that, you know, there's some reasonable exploitation there, they're going to notify DCBS. DCBS takes it, you know, orally or in writing, and then guess who they notify? They ended up notifying DHS. We have no idea what the length of time period that's going to take for an investigation. I mean, because look, some of us are in human services, and we're taking a look at seeing what's going on with the investigations of foster parents and allegations, and now all of a sudden I'm just taking that and transferring it over to this level for reasonable belief. Your involvement with the investigation time period as well. And then, if you finally conclude that there is sufficient evidence to move forward with, you notify law enforcement, because they're the only ones that are going to be able to do anything with this as a Class A misdemeanor. I see this so convoluted, so time-consuming, I don't know how you're going to do it.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson, we're going to be sitting down with DHS in the interim and working out time frames and mechanisms in order to share that information. I understand and get that when we set those up, we need to be very timely about how we process those and to make sure that those reports get to DHS as soon as possible.
Representative Greenlick?
I'd like to testify.
Okay. Never mind. Any further questions? Thank you, panel. Call Roger Beyer and Art Towers.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could just ask you a question. Are we intending to move this bill today? I've got some concerns.
Okay. Thank you. You might not be ready yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing NAFA Oregon. NAFA is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Here testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 95. First, I want to start out by saying NAFA supports protecting the elderly and vulnerable citizens from financial exploitations. Our members work with people daily to help make them secure financially. And the last thing we want to see a person's savings being taken away from them illegitimately. But with that said, we still have some concerns with the bill, even though the bill, is, from our perspective, is much improved from when it first was introduced. We worked in front of the two Senate committees. I met with DCBS in the interim before the bill was introduced. We've worked to improve the bill all along, but it still has some issues from our perspective. So FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulation Authority, on February 5th, I believe it is, of this year, enacted new rules on financial exploitation, and we believe this bill should be made to work in harmony better with those rules than it currently does. And I would point out that I would say House Bill 2622, which your committee and the House floor passed earlier this session, is more in line with that approach of rules. And so we would prefer that this bill be conformed more to that perspective. But if mandatory reporting is the goal of the state, NAFA believes it should be the company, not the qualified individuals, that make those reports. This would keep the agents from getting involved in many times what are family disputes under the definition of financial exploitation in this bill, we think will happen. Let me give you an example. An agent has a client who's an elderly widow who has a child who is receiving a large monthly payment from the mother and appears to be doing no work to get that. The child is also a third party named on the investment account, and all these transactions are happening with complete consent of the mother. Well, under the definition of financial exploitation under this bill, that would require reporting by our people if they know of this transaction going on. Yet all that's going to really happen there is the agent gets between the mother and the child because they're doing it voluntarily and willingly. So that just puts our agents in a bad position. Another issue NAFA has with this bill is the idea of training. You heard about just now, and I'm happy to hear that DCBS is considering training, trying to figure out how they're going to train. Because before today, they made the statement that FINRA would train to the new rules. Well, FINRA will train to their new rules, which are not the same as Oregon's new rules. So Oregon needs to find a way to train these security providers. Our associations like NAFA can train for those agents who have continuing education requirements. And I'm curious because in the Senate committee, it was testified that insurance agents who sell certain types of annuities would be qualified under this bill as qualified individuals. I just heard them testify now that insurance providers or insurance providers would not be under this bill, so I'm curious to know which it is. I've now in two different committees, we've heard two different things. I think that needs to be clarified, whether or not insurance producers who sell certain types of annuities are included or not. But for securities licensees at the state level, there is not continuing education required. So DCBS needs to figure out, and like I said, I'm glad to hear that they're planning on figuring out how to do that. They can make training of new licensees a requirement for the exam, which I hope they will do, but they need to figure out how to train those existing licensees who don't have to go through continuing education at the state level currently. And the final concern we have this bill is the fiscal statement that was issued on the Senate floor as the bill passed the Senate. The bill offers immunity to those who, from prosecution at both civilly and criminally, from those who report in good faith, but no such immunity is offered for those who don't report. So it is our opinion that agents, because of that, will over-report to protect themselves. They almost certainly will have to if they want to protect themselves. You just heard, and we heard in the Senate, that 16% of Oregonians meet the definition of vulnerable persons as defined by this bill, and that 20% of this population are victims of fraud, and only one, and this is different now, in the Senate it was 1 in 44 cases are reported. Mr. Blackwell just said 1 of 20 cases reported, so it's either way, it's a small number of cases are reported. If those numbers are accurate and agents will be incentivized to over-report, is DCBS and the other agency prepared to handle the tens of thousands of cases that are going to be coming forward? Because there are 4 million Oregonians, if you do the math, that should be about 128,000 cases should be reported if those numbers are accurate. This division of DCBS is almost entirely funded by fees, and those fees are provided by our licensees. What's going to happen if there's a budget shortfall? Will DCBS be coming back and seeking a fee increase to cover the shortfall? I don't think our agents will be in position to be supporting such a fee increase to have them paying for something that they're not responsible for. So, Mr. Chair, with my testimony that I submitted to OLIS, I attached a copy of the new FINRA rules, so you'll have that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Representative?
Thank you, Chair Barker. And Roger, I apologize. I came in late, came in halfway through your testimony. Frankly, I was kind of inclined to support this bill, but listening, I've got a couple of questions. Currently, is it the industry standard that, written or unwritten, it's the rule you simply don't disclose, period, regardless of whether you see potential fraud or someone taking advantage of an elderly person?
Mr. Chair and Representative Weil, I would think certainly not. My members, NAFA has a code of conduct. In order to be a member of NAFA, you have to be a good steward and be helping your clients and work in their best interest. And certainly part of that standard, if you suspect abuse of your clients, you would report that under the voluntary system. We do support the voluntary system. We do support the FINRA rules, and our association supported those at the national level. And we would have preferred this bill to be a training requirement and a better reporting system, a voluntary reporting system, so that more people are aware of it and more people would conform to that practice who are not NAFA members.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I want to make sure I'm reading the bill correctly. I see the shall report in the first portion, but if the reporting does not take place, where's the penalty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Weil, I believe you would have to look on the last page of the bill. Lines 9 through 11 on page 4 of the bill is a penalty provision.
Violation of Section 3 or of any rule adopted is a Class A violation. Okay. So the protection for failing to report that's up above in the bill doesn't apply to the agencies taking action on a failure to report. Because there's up above, there's this provision that essentially says, I apologize.
Mr. Chair, my understanding of the bill is that if you act in good faith under sections 3 and 5, I believe, are the two sections off the top of my head, that you have immunity from prosecution both criminally and civilly if you report. But if you fail to report, and you should have reported, you are subject to violation.
So if you've done that and you've done it reasonably, is the concern that the agency is going to feel like you should have done more, and that's when the Class A violation would be imposed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, no. I believe it's just the opposite, that the bill as drafted will encourage agents, as I said, to over-report, and that puts agents in a position where they're in a no-win position between their clients or potentially in family disputes with between their clients and family members. And
they're protected if they over-report as well,
protected
though, right?
If they over-report, as long as they act in good faith.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I just wanted to register our organization's support for the bill around some of the same topics that came up just now. The idea that if they're going to be, we don't like the immunity, right? We think the people who harm people should be held accountable for their actions. That's our normal position. But in this case, immunity would be granted if they are mandatory reporters. And we think that's a reasonable trade-off. And so for that reason, among others, we support this legislation. Our members fight for people who've been defrauded by financial institutions and defrauded financially generally. And so we support this legislation. Happy to answer questions or go into detail.
Any questions, Representative?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roger, question for you. How to word this? I'm wording based on just some research I've been doing. Would this bill protect older people when it comes to a financial advisor not disclosing important information to a client before that person invests in stocks or indices? That makes sense?
Mr. Chair and Representative Post, I don't know the answer to that question. In the original version of the bill, we had concerns, as it was originally drafted, that a financial advisor could be considered liable if they recommended two different accounts or funds, per se, and one of them outperformed the other, and the person had chose the lower performing account, that financial advisor would be subject to then abuse, actually, because the definition of financial exploitation. I believe that has been cleared up in this version, so I don't think we have that concern anymore. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
It sort of does. I'll tell you, I'm sorry, follow up. I just had something sent to me that somebody is, they're watching this right now, and they're trying to understand what's going on here, and they said, could we do something, would this be the vehicle to add something like this, a list of 7 things that as a person would sign with their financial advisor to protect them, that perhaps this bill might be a vehicle for that. So, for instance, my financial advisor has informed me that the total amount of fees I will pay up front is blank. So there's a list of questions like this that apparently is not done right now, at least not in easy to read print that a lot of the elderly need. It's in fine print on the 27th page, part D. I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm concerned because this is, I think this bill might help in this situation, but on the other hand, I have some concerns that Representative Olson just brought up about DHS being able to handle this. So I'm not sure what my question was. Roger, I'm sorry, I've lost track. I'm reading a lot of information at one time and listening, and
I see you become a senior citizen.
What? I know. I'm not even.
There you go.
Although Taco Bell does call me a senior now, so
that's nice.
It's nice. 20% off. I just want to make sure senior citizens are protected because I'm right now somebody very close to me is very vulnerable and has been hurt by financial advisors, and they see this bill as perhaps a way to help.
Thank you,
Chair Barker. I think I can answer the question the Representative Post raised. I think that's why the mandatory reporting is a positive feature. The idea that someone who's financially vulnerable may be vulnerable to other types of abuse, you know, makes sense to me that that would be a good reason for these entities to be required to report, because maybe that could, if other abuse is taking place, as the previous witness testified, we can might be able to get at that too to make sure that people are safe.
Well, I guess the mandatory reporting, it depends on who's. So if a financial advisor is doing the wrongdoing, who's mandatory reporting on the financial advisor? That's what I'm getting at. I don't think there's any protections that I've seen from the financial advisor. Okay.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I haven't heard in the testimony today to any great degree, and Representative Post, you just brought up some of those concerns. I know the conversations that we've had with our financial advisor, and I also know him on a personal level within the community. He has a ton of federal regulations he works under, a ton of things. I've asked him to do something once. He goes, oh, no, couldn't do that. And it was something very benign and simple. So what I'd like to hear is in this conversation, because at this point I think the bill has an amazingly good intent. I have extreme concerns on how the bill gets us to that good intent, and I don't even know that I could support it at this point yet without some amendments. But I would like to hear how financial advisors are regulated, and if there's truly a gap that we need to fill. Maybe I'm being naive in my small community, but I got to tell you, our financial advisor knows everything about us, including our son, who has a custodial account, and we discuss those things. So I guess I'm missing the urgency here and the gap in regulations that would cover this without this bill. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can speak to all the federal regulations.
You can't, but I think we need to have somebody in here that can talk about that, because we've missed this whole other layer of regulation in the conversation today.
I will point out, and I believe this committee also passed Senate Bill 96 this session, which was a bill requiring insurance or financial providers or financial advisors to be licensed, or excuse me, to carry E&O insurance. My association did not take position on that bill, but that bill was intended to get at some of those issues you just talked about, albeit I don't know that it hits the mark, because E&O insurance does not cover fraud and criminal acts. So if a person is intently harming another person, whether they have E&O insurance or not, is not going to be covered if it's intentional. That's fraud, or that's a criminal act. So that bill may help in getting some of the issues that are raised by Representative Post and Representative Springer. I don't know if it gets all the way there in that world.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bile.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm interested, Arthur, maybe you're not the right one to answer this question, but something Roger said just clicked in a second ago, and that is that if we really do have 16% that are being taken advantage of here, where's DCBS going to get the money to respond to these complaints? This fiscal impact issue kind of is resonating with me.
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, just playing with the numbers while Mr. Beyer was testifying, he talked about 4 million, excuse me, 4 million Oregonians times 16% are vulnerable, times 20% are exposed to the sort of crime. That's 128,000. But that assumes that every person who's vulnerable has an account with one of the people involved here, which I doubt is the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we need a little more work on this one.
Yep. Yeah, I was just going to say I might want to hear some more from DCBS on this before we. I didn't necessarily mean now, but
some of us have heard from them already.
Yeah, I wasn't here for a lot of.
It would be good to know from probably Aaron and also Christian to know where they're thinking of for the impact for the, you know, covering for the dollars. I mean, that's what I'm hearing too. So,
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson, I certainly can defer to Aaron. Our intent with this bill was to create a fairly automatic process for moving most of the complaints to DHS. We asked for the bill. It really is our burden to take that on. However, the process was supposed to be largely automatic to DHS. Now, when we find an issue that may revolve around the Oregon securities law or some of the other laws that we administer around, I don't know, mortgage lending or other matters, those would we would take those up through normal channels. And so while we might see an uptick in cases on our end as a result, I don't think it'll be nearly 120,000. So.
Okay. We'll hold off on moving the bill today. Just take another look at it. So.
Okay.
Okay. I'll close the public hearing on. Thank you very much. Or did you want to?
Chair Barker, if,
sure, please.
If it pleases the committee, I would love to just add a few clarifying points and address a couple of the questions that came up. Again, Christian Hale with Department of Human Services. Thank you, Chair Barker and co-chairs, members of the committee. As a part of DHS, first of all, I would just like to strongly reiterate that in our position, there is no such thing as over-reporting elder abuse. Our screeners are available at central office and in counties around the state to take these calls. We take all calls seriously. And as we get to the numbers, which I'll address in just a moment, you know, many calls, all of the calls go through a process called screening, and that is where the person taking the call decides whether this is, whether the allegations do fall into a type of abuse that should be investigated. And if not, those calls are referred out. And I'd just like to address a couple of the numbers that our data support and are published and available on our website. And I'm referring particularly to Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation annual report from 2015. That was published in 2016. Another one will be out shortly, I hope. But there was some concern about just how many tens or dozens of thousands of people might be affected by this bill. I think I can bring that number safely down and address that concern. Particularly in 2015, overall, there were 43,000 reports of all types of abuse, not just financial exploitation, but all. Out of those, when investigations were complete, only 4,000 odd vulnerable persons were determined to have been abused. And more specifically and relevant to this inquiry, there were, I hesitate to say just, but there were 1,526 substantiated cases of financial exploitation. That is still significant, representatives, because that that qualifies as 30% of all substantiated abuse cases, but out of the many thousands and tens of thousands of, in theory, vulnerable Oregonians, as they would be defined under this bill and under other provisions of Oregon law, in fact, there were 1,526 in 2015. Of course, Department of Human Services is concerned if that number should continue to rise, which is why we fully support reporting all concerns. Perhaps, if I may, I'd like to just briefly address the question from Representative Post. Representative, I believe you asked whether this particular bill addressed or was intended to address poor or inappropriate advice by a financial advisor in selecting financial investments. From my point of view and in my experience, having been on the work group, I don't believe that was ever the intent of this particular bill. This was modeled on a national act, and it's my understanding that that's why DCBS brought this forward. It's certainly true that the provisions of the Model Act do closely mirror what Oregon has long tried to do in its elder abuse and mandatory reporting scheme, and that's one of the reasons why DHS does support this bill. I'd be happy to take any other questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 95. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 508.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 508A conditionally exempts from public disclosure images of a dead body or parts of a dead body that are a part of a law enforcement investigation.
John Hanlon, Kevin Neely, and Arthur Towers, please. And Sheriff Hanlon, you go ahead. Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Hanlon. I am the sheriff of Douglas County, currently serving my third term. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here before you today to support Senate Bill 508 on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Peace Officers Association. I've been with Douglas County, the Sheriff's Office, for over 28 years. Prior to being elected sheriff, I served as the commander of the Sheriff's Office Detectives Division and the Major Crimes Team. As a result of my years of experience in criminal investigations, I can tell you and firmly believe that the disclosure of photographs of the deceased or any images of victims of crime or the deceased should be diligently protected, and that nothing good can come from the disclosure of such images during a public records request. Whether it be the typical homicide case, which on average occurs more than 100 times a year here in Oregon, or a fatal traffic crash, for which there's been over 500 this past year in 2016, or a tragic school shooting like the one we experienced in my home county at Umpqua Community College on October 1st, 2015, all of these cases create some opportunity through public records requests to obtain and exploit photos and images of someone's deceased loved one. I consider this a form of sensationalism that is immoral, it's unethical, and it's unhealthy and harmful. As a law enforcement official, I feel a profound responsibility to seek justice for the victims of the heinous crimes that I'm talking about. I'm hopeful that you will decide that the release of these images are not in the best interest of the public and will support the passage of Senate Bill 508 in order to protect the dignity of the deceased and the privacy of the families of these victims. You don't have to go far to find examples of the exploitation of these types of photographs that I'm referring to. You can get on the internet. And trust me, I'm not a real technical savvy guy, but you can go on Google and look up O.J. Simpson case and find literally hundreds of victims or of pictures of the victims of that homicide, both of Nicole Simpson and of Ron Goldman. There are literally thousands of pictures of deceased victims that can be found on Pinterest, and on YouTube, Photo Bucket. And they're not just pictures of victims of crime, but victims of automobile crashes, plane crashes, suicide, accidental deaths, drownings, you name it. My point here is that if those images are made available through public information laws, there is undoubtedly someone out there who will, with no regard for what's in the public's best interest or considering the health and welfare of the victims of the families of these victims, will display those images on social media, if nowhere else. As we prepare to respond to dozens, if not hundreds, of public information requests involving the Umpqua Community College tragedy, I become increasingly concerned about the privacy of the victims and their families of that tragedy. I have personally met with the families of all the victims of UCC on numerous occasions. They have all shared with me their anxiety and their fears that this information and these photographs could potentially be shared through public information requests processes once the UCC shooting investigation is declared closed, which is we're very close to making that declaration. Unanimously, these families have asked that I do anything and everything that I can to protect them from reliving that horrific day. I respectfully urge that you support this bill. I believe that if this bill is passed, it will take a substantial step in protecting the privacy of these people and the families of other deceased persons, as they very much deserve. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm more than willing to answer any questions you may have.
And thank you, Sheriff, for not repeating that person's name over and over again. I really appreciate you doing that.
Sheriff Barker, absolutely. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mr. Neely.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I following up on that is challenging, and I think that Sheriff Hanlon really underscored the importance of this bill, and I'm here on behalf of ODA, and they're really grateful for his shepherding of this through this building. The one thing I do want to underscore, this really is about eliminating the commercialization of victims, and it happens every single day. And as Sheriff Hanlon said, there are literally hundreds of websites, and it's not just the fancy O.J. Simpson cases. It's all of these cases. And district attorneys and all of law enforcement are getting these public requests on a weekly, if not daily, basis, and we are struggling with finding an exemption that fits for all of these. And so this exemption squarely answers the question. But at the same time, in those instances in which the release of these photo images is important, there's a mechanism by which the requester can seek the court's permission to grant to get these images. So it has the right back door, but really slams the front door on those people that want to use these images for their own personal financial gain in really the most disgusting way. So with that, Oregon District Attorneys Association strongly supports this legislation.
Okay, thank you. Art.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We completely 1,000% agree with the thrust of this legislation and the intent of where it's going. And but I am concerned about one perhaps unintended consequence, and that is limiting access of the photos to the legal representatives of the deceased, that our members fight for those families in cases where the death was caused due to negligence. And sometimes the criminal photographs will could have a bearing on determining liability and responsibility in the deaths. And so our proposed change is small, but I think important, that the personal representative of the estate of the deceased person or a legal representative of the estate of the deceased person should be able to receive the images of the deceased. And so that's what we're looking at. Again, I can't really envision where a DA or where a police department would deny that request, but it feels better to have that language in there just to clear anything up that's misconstrued later on.
I think that the one thing I would point out is that the bill does clearly state that it needs to not be an unreasonable invasion of privacy for the family or deceased person. So I think we felt like there was already a mechanism in there that accomplished the goal that Mr. Towers is seeking to accomplish. And again, I, as he just said, I really have a hard time envisioning a situation in which a law enforcement agency or a district attorney would withhold that. And if they did, of course, there's another mechanism, a second backup mechanism by which they could seek that information from a judge. That's not to say we wouldn't consider changing it, but.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with Arthur. It's not the tightest it's not the tightest statute for getting it into a civil case, because that's fitting it into the public interest in a private civil case, I think, could be challenging. So, you know, maybe it's sufficient to make sure that there's a legislative record that this statute allows for that kind of disclosure.
Okay, I offered the chance to get the amendment. I've reviewed the bill, and I think the bill is okay as is. I'll ask you to put that in the record.
Yeah.
Okay. So we will. I don't plan to move the amendment. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would agree with that. We're talking about the family here. So I guess my question to you, Sheriff, is given the language here, images of dead body parts and so forth, that are part of a law enforcement agency investigation, if public disclosure would create an unreasonable invasion of privacy. So what about the family who says, and I've dealt with tons of awful pictures and tons of families going through this, and I can't think of one instance where anybody remotely wanted to see anything. But let's say that occurred. Don't know under what circumstances that would. This does not prevent you from bringing them into your office and saying, here's the pictures, and letting them look at the pictures there, correct?
Yeah, Chair Barker, Representative Springer, that's absolutely correct. And we have a standard for how we notify next of kin of a fatality. And we don't generally send them a note. We don't give them a phone call. We make personal contact with them. And I could see that a request such as you just described would be handled very similarly. We would invite them in to the office. We could ask if they would like to have, you know, clergy or a counselor or our chaplain present, and we could show them the photograph or photographs that they requested to see, or an agent of the family that they've identified.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You follow up.
Thank you for that. And it's amazing what I have learned in this community, in this committee. I have Googled things I never considered Googling. And I watch my history closely because of that. I just Googled dead body pictures, hit images. Oh my gosh. And they're not some of the worst of what I've seen, but they weren't just toe tags. There's a whole bunch of stuff. What is the value, this is a rhetorical question, what is the value of somebody's kid or spouse being posted on Facebook? Obviously, there's no value in that. And you're not trying in this bill to conceal facts, correct? You're not trying to conceal any information contained in the report, just images, correct?
Yeah, Chair Barker, Representative Springer, that's absolutely correct. In fact, you know, law enforcement recognizes the benefit and value in being open and sharing information. It's just been my experience that the sharing of these types of photographs There is no value other than in a training purpose. And in fact, there are some states that have adopted similar laws to prevent law enforcement from sharing these photographs. In particular, I'm thinking of a state that the coroner or the medical examiner used photographs without permission of the family to demonstrate and for training purposes, and the next of kin found out and discovered, and so that became the reason behind the big push for the similar bill. I don't know how to answer the first half of your question, because I don't think any of us in this room think the way that those that want to post these photographs on social media or in other publications or media forums think, and so I don't know, other than sensationalism obviously has become a big issue for some media outlets to sell their products.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps for Kevin, prior to the hearing, I had heard that there was some concern over the wording in the bill as it sits currently. Is that not true, or is it? Has that been cleared up?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I'm not aware of any concerns, and you're looking at two of the three people, or the two people that testified on this in the Senate, and I think we did try to clear up a couple of questions in the Senate. They thought it might be too expansive in the Senate related to any images relating to a death scene. This bill, as you just read, Representative Springer, it limits it to images actually of the physical parts and or images of the dead body itself. So it's a pretty narrow focus.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, if I may make one more comment. So as you know, we conventionally think of all the photographs and the images that law enforcement produce at a crime scene. With the invent of the body camera that we're now all most agencies are wearing, we're getting a thousand times more photographs and images of these crime scenes and of death scenes compared to what we did 5 years ago. And so, you know, the media, the people that are interested in getting their hands on these types of photographs are aware of that, and it seems like we're being bombarded ever more so with public information requests for those images.
Thank you. And just to follow up, so maybe I'm completely off base here, but we had had a discussion before we started about the question of whether this was this prohibition was more suited for civil litigation, and that we should have kept something that was a little stronger for criminal in terms of whether the evidence would allow for the release or not. So perhaps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, let me try this and see if it is helpful. And if it's not, you can tell me.
Save me from this.
So if you look at page one of the bill, lines 11 to 15, there's a nearly identical provision in the public records exemption that protects information of a personal nature if public disclosure would constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy. So arguably what this bill does is says these pictures are a subset of this broader exemption. Mm-hmm. So it takes existing language and applies it to images of a dead body. So I don't know if that's responsive or not.
Okay. So as far as everyone's concerned, we're good with this language.
You're asking the one person you probably shouldn't be asking.
There you go. I mean, just in general, Mr. Chair, that's my question.
I'm good. Representative Pyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the vein of making sure that the record is clear, I do think the language is probably okay, even in spite of Arthur's concerns, as long as we make it clear that there is no intent whatsoever in this bill to limit the use of those images in connection with either criminal or civil litigation as may be determined necessary by a court. So that if a judge picks this up and goes, golly, maybe I can't let the defense or the plaintiff use these pictures, and we've got on the record that was absolutely not the intent, I think we're probably okay.
Thank you. You know, I was actually raising my hand to affirm what Representative or Majority Leader Williamson said, and you built on it. So there must be an ability to have those viewable only in camera, you know, keep them from being eligible for broader view. But I think we need to make the record clear that if someone needs those to pursue justice in a court, that they have access. And it sounds like we can do that.
Mr. Chair, can I make one more comment?
And I think back in the PGE versus Boley days, we might have been more concerned with the very specific language. But I think the way the Supreme Court is currently looking at legislative intent, if we just make it absolutely clear, we should be okay on this. Do you disagree, Arthur?
Chair Barker, Representative Vile, the members of my organization are very, very trained to think of the worst case scenario. And that's why we want the wording. As a layperson, I think getting it on the record is just fine. And there's probably 1,000 trial attorneys around the state watching this hearing who will be racing through the door to, you know, kill me here in a minute. But I think getting it on the record probably should do the trick.
Can I wait? One more comment?
Please.
So in reading the bill, Josh's point was we're putting a sub B under subsection 2, right? Section 1, 2, A, and then B. Mm-hmm. So A, line 12, says if the public disclosure would constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy, comma. In the language we're considering, the one concern I have where the language might not be tight enough is invasion of privacy of the family. So it could be an inner family issue, and there may not be consensus in the family. Mm. So that's one place where you could end up. It doesn't specify who's giving permission or whose privacy it is or how that's determined by the court. The court can probably figure that out. But that is one place where I think in a civil case, you may end up in additional issues, because that's not, it's not the estate of the person, right? And there's clearly an estate of the person or somebody who is the representative of the estate of the person. Because it says family, there's no clear decision maker in the way the language is written. And family can mean a lot of things.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may follow up on that. So this is not a out there scenario. This is a very reasonable scenario. So I'm trying to think through this. So unfortunately, you have the deceased person is an adult child or not quite an adult child, 16, 17, or whatever. And you have very bad blood between
Mom and Dad.
Mm-hmm. Right. Dad says, I want to see. I've heard the mom who said, you're lying. They're not dead. Show me. So you've got maybe that case, Dad saying, show me. You have Mom saying, I don't know. But don't you have Dad invited in to the office? Here's picture. Does Mom have recourse?
Well, I would think I don't know. I would think, Mr. Chair, the way that would play out is that law enforcement would manage the disclosure of the photos to the family. But my concern is what happens when you have, say it's a domestic violence homicide, and family is perpetrator. And so when you look at it in the civil context, how do you deal with that kind of scenario when the family situation is a little more complicated? That's what I'm concerned about, because I think that your scenario is, I would guess, and I would ask the sheriff if this doesn't preclude you from managing that sort of family disclosure situation. It's when you then disclose it to a third party or to an attorney in a civil claim, or that it's that next step beyond who comes in to view the photos with law enforcement.
Right? Yeah, so Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, that's absolutely correct. And in fact, in our situation back at UCC, we have a family situation where one of the victims, exactly as you explained. And so we just have to deal with both parents individually. And, you know, if the father wants to see images and the mother doesn't, then That's a simple, there's a simple answer to that, and that's just invite him into the office. Your situation, Vice Chair Williamson, obviously is a much more complicated situation, but it's not, I don't think the law was ever intended to preclude anybody from seeing the images that that don't have the right to.
Right. And the other situation I worry about is, you know, these pictures can be monetized, so if somebody's offered, if mom and dad have bad blood and one of them is offered money for disclosure of the pictures, which is how the inquirer gets their pictures, that in that situation, having the disclosure be by family may make it a little more complicated, and maybe the court just figures that out.
That's what I would rely on the court. Yeah. If some of those are going to get out, there's...
I just wanted to air that on the record.
So that was going to be my next comment, sort of where you went, Mr. Chair. Nothing in this law prevents somebody from petitioning the court for anything they want to petition the court for.
Right.
That's correct. So there's still that piece. Anybody can ask for anything from the court.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing over a work session on Senate Bill 508A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 508A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 508A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Would you like to carry it?
Okay.
Representative Williamson will carry it. You can make the record even clearer on the floor.
As long as Arthur Towers drafts the record that I'll be making.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 713A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 713A submits the biennial modifications to the rules of the Criminal Justice Commission for legislative approval.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I don't know if we got a half hour left here. I think we can barrage him with questions.
I've got some.
Oh, perfect.
No joke.
The clean shaven Mr. Schmidt, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair,
isn't it?
Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. Here today on Senate Bill 713, this is the Criminal Justice Commission's biannual rule approval bill. Pursuant to ORS 137-667, the CJC has to bring this bill every 2 years for any rules that our commission adopts to the criminal code. And so many of you see bills all the time that are changing or doing some sort of amendments to current existing criminal statutes. And more these days, those bills say the Criminal Justice Commission shall rank this as a blank, 6-4, you know. It's more and more common that the legislature is prescribing to our commission what we shall do with the ranking. However, every once in a while, there are bills where our commissioners have discretion to rank things and or to designate certain crimes as person crimes or not as person crimes. So the vast majority of the rules that are listed in Senate Bill 713 in front of you are of the nature of changes that my commission has adopted based on legislative direction. The vast majority of those are bills where the legislature said, CJC shall do this. I will tell you that in those circumstances, my commission has done as instructed with fidelity to the instructions. We have not deviated from any of the legislation where we were told to rank it as such, even though theoretically I suppose we could because they have to vote on it. They have not chosen to exercise that discretion. There are a few of the rules where our commissioners had discretion, and in those instances, they voted on it. They had a robust discussion. There are 7 voting members of our commission. Currently, Representative Stark sits on our commission. Representative Olson sat on our commission for many of these specific rule changes over the last biennium. And they can attest to the fact that we have a good debate. There is broad representation around across the continuum of commissioners. We have a district attorney, we had a judge, we have county council, we have defense attorney, we have community corrections directors. And so what happens when our commission has discretion to rank something is they, as they use their professional judgment and have a conversation and talk back and forth and eventually land on an area where they think this crime will fit into the sentencing guidelines. I will tell you that all of the rule changes that are in this bill were unanimously approved by my commission. So not at any point was there any kind of disagreement. Even so, you got, like I said, players from across the system, and every time they have a very cordial, respectful, and well-informed discussion of what it should be, and they invariably have, over the last 2 years, always landed at the same place. So that's what this bill represents. We are, pursuant to that ORS 137-667, instructed to then come back to the legislature with a bill and put into it all the rule adoptions that we made. And so that's what this bill does, even though, like I said before, the majority of the changes that we made were at the direction of the legislature. So essentially, you are directing our commission to adopt these rule changes. We do that, and then statute directs us to come back to you for your approval of the adoptions that you directed us to make. And that's what we're doing.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, 164337, computer crimes, theft of an intimate image. The commission made that a person crime, not a property crime. Why is that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Williamson, very well done for reading deep into our rules. That's true. The discussion really, the discussion around that by our commissioners really centered on the fact that unlike other property crimes, this was of a very personal nature, and the intent of the crime was really less to steal something of value and more to actually injure a person emotionally, generally in this regard. So across the commissioners, they discussed it. They went back and forth because this being a property crime, it is an oddity to see it as a person crime. But ultimately, they unanimously felt that that was the right place to rank it because it really involves around the intent.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Okay. Everybody find my gavel here. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 713A and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill, which one is it? 713A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 713A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just a question,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. Unlike Representative Williamson, I have not read every single one of these rules that is affected, and I'm just asking her to confirm that I won't be sorry that I voted for this.
No, the vast majority, Chair Barker, Representative Vile, the vast majority, as Mike said, are things that we made them do, so they have no discretion, and in the list of places where they have discretion, there was nothing that seemed odd at all other than the middle of the computer theft statute, there's now a person crime stuck in the middle of it. So that was my question, is what the discussion was around how they pulled that out and made theft of something a person crime. Other than that, it's all very straightforward, and I can forward this list of things on to you if you want.
That would be most appreciated. Thank you, Representative.
Well that brings up the question for you then. Are there varying levels of attorney reading style? You know,
oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like kind of lump you guys.
Being human beings, there is. Okay, so we have a motion before us on the floor. Are there any objections to moving the bill? Hearing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry the bill? Representative Olson, please, will be carried. Thank you.
Man. Wow. Okay. How magnanimous.
Okay. We stand adjourned, committee. Thank you very much.
Man. Wow. Okay. How magnanimous.
Okay. We stand adjourned.